and officially turn things over to your presenter, Taylor Jones from Culture Point. Taylor?
Thank you. So first of all, I want to say hello and thank you to everybody for being here. It's 10 a.m. on the West Coast where I am this time, and so good afternoon to everybody on the East Coast, and good morning to everybody on the West Coast, and good day to everybody in between, I guess. So I will say very quickly to Gene that it looks like I do actually have live real-time updates on this, so we are in great shape for this presentation. All right, so my name is Taylor Jones. I'm here on behalf of Culture Point LLC, and what we're going to be talking about today is presentation skills. And I want to start with the course objectives. So we have three objectives for today. First is to understand how people evaluate presentations. The second is to review best practices for presentations. And the third is to develop a game plan for your presentations. And I understand that all or most of you will be giving presentations this year, specifically about Superfund sites. So this is important material that is affected by your presentation skills. So I'm here to help ease you down the path of good presentations. So our agenda today is going to be an introduction, then an overview of the research, the relevant research on presentation skills. Then we'll move into putting it all together. So without further ado, I want to give an introduction to who I am. So I'm a facilitator with a decade of experience teaching and facilitating difficult topics around diversity and inclusion. Culture Point, the company that I work for, does a lot of work with a variety of agencies, with the military, and with the private sector around diversity and inclusion and around leadership and performance. And what that means is that I have a lot of experience with some very contentious material and with a variety of different audiences. So the way that I like to think about this is that there's actually three kinds of audiences that I generally run into. The first is the volunteers. That's people who are just inherently interested in the presentation that I'm going to give, and they want to know all about it, and they're very excited to be there. The second is the vacationers. That's people who are just excited to be away from their desk or to be doing something different than their usual task. And the last is hostages. And I expect that everybody here is volunteers or vacationers and not in the hostage category. But if you're in the hostage category, it's a slightly different expectation. You're there against your will. You have to sit through this presentation. And you know, usually we'll try and work out a way to get through it together. But I think it's an important distinction because not all presentations are going to be presentations where everybody in the room is happy to be there and excited for what they're hearing. I think, and you can all correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think that you're all in the first two categories of vacationers and hopefully all volunteers. But the point is that there's different skills for these different groups. I'm also a quantitative social scientist with teaching experience across a variety of classes and over 50 conference talks, invited lecturers, academic talks for the general public. My background is that I'm a linguist, and I do research primarily on regional variation in African-American English, but I do a lot of research in sociolinguistics, which is the field of study that looks at how social factors affect language, and that's affecting language change. That's how they're related to language use. So that's gender, race, age, education, all of these different social factors and how they affect how we use language. I look at both, you know, pronunciation and changes happening in language, and then also how we think strategically about how we use language. So I have work that I've done on microaggressions. I have work that I've done on slurs. I have work that I've done on insults. I have work that I've done on strategy and how we think about how we interact with one another. What I will say is that my experience with conference talks and invited lectures has actually given way with some recent research to a new domain, which is radio and television interviews. So I'm a very, very well-seasoned presenter at this point. And then lastly, while it may not seem relevant at first, I'm a performer with a background playing music professionally. So before grad school, I spent about 7 years working as a jazz musician in New York. And I would claim that that is relevant because all of this goes back towards managing the room. And so you'll all be giving a presentation. You may find that you have 30 people in the room. You may have 300 people in the room. And my claim is going to be that the tools for managing those rooms are largely the same. And it all boils down to having a set of presentation skills that you can fall back on where you know that you are in charge of the room. So all of that is tied together by communicating scientific ideas to the general public through presentations and relying on the platform skills that we'll discuss shortly. Now, what I'm going to do, since everybody's muted for the most part, is I'll pause as I move through the sections of this presentation to allow questions. I assume that there aren't questions at this point because I've just introduced myself and that's all. But as I go through this, I very much welcome feedback, and we'll actually discuss feedback at length later on. But I welcome feedback and comments and questions, and I will pause regularly to allow questions to be read out, and I can then clarify if anybody has anything that's sort of not clear, or if you have any other issues that come up. So without further ado, I would like to get into the overview of the research, and this is really the question of why is this important, so why bother? And the reason is that there's a wealth of research that indicates that platform skills affect perceived credibility. So you're all public-facing. Your work is important, and it's important that it's communicated effectively. And the argument that I'm going to make is that platform skills are skills. They're not inherent. It's not an unchanging aspect of somebody's personality. So these are things that you can learn, practice, and improve. And that's the main idea here. So as we move on, the research tells us a lot about platform skills and about how they affect credibility and responses to presentations. So one, we can tell when people believe what they're saying and when they're confident in it. And what I have here is a quick overview. I don't have all the research on this. I just have a couple of leads that you can follow. I usually, you know, being from an academic background, I usually like to have a citation for anything that I say. So especially when we're talking about the research here, I don't want to just say, okay, we can tell verbal versus nonverbal, blah, 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 and then not give you a real citation from where that's from. These are not the only citations on this, but they are a start. So first, the verbal versus nonverbal, there's a fair amount of research that says that we can tell when somebody is confident and when they believe what they're saying, when the verbal and the nonverbal cues don't line up. So saying something where the actual text is straightforward and confident is not necessarily enough, because if we deliver our presentation, if we speak the words, but we speak them in a way that is unsure and uncertain and not confident, then people pick up on that. And they'll start to question the credibility of the statements that you're making if it sounds like you don't really believe them. So there's a ton of research on the sounds of confidence and the sounds of doubt, and a lot of it boils down to the rate at which you speak, the volume at which you speak, and the intonation contours. And intonational contours are something that may differ across gender, across racial and ethnic categories and cultural styles, but in general, what we find is that a lower pitch, in your normal pitch range, a lower pitch and slower speech and a slightly smaller pitch range is normally perceived as more confident than, you know, all sorts of changes in pitch and speaking very quickly and speaking high in your register. And that's backed up as well by other research that says that professionals lower vocal frequency when giving expert advice. So there's a fantastic study where they had people in a room, and they asked them questions about their specific field, but they also had a researcher who was associated with the scientists who were performing the study, posing as somebody who was lost in the building, and they asked these experts for directions in a building that they weren't familiar with. And the real test here was what's the difference in how they speak when it's a subject matter that they're very familiar with versus a question from a lost person in a building that they're not familiar with, and found that when talking about something that they're experts on, professionals lower their vocal frequency. When they're unsure, and this should sound normal to people, when they're unsure, they'll raise their voice significantly, raise their pitch significantly, I should say. I will also say that the Clues to confidence are measurable. So like I said, pitch, intonation, and speed influence perceptions of speaker confidence. And we're more likely to believe and cooperate with people who send signals of confidence. The interesting thing about this is that the research also tells us that that's even when we later think it wasn't about presentation skills. So there's a handful of excellent studies, Clark 2008 is one of them, that demonstrate that people will evaluate speakers based on presentation skills, even when they think they're later evaluating the content of the presentation. And one of the ways they did this was with matched guys tests. But the big takeaway is that the way that we communicate this information, whatever the information is important. And so if we're confident in what we're saying, and we know that we're confident in what we're saying, other people will pick up on that as well, and they're much more likely to have your message resonate with them. So the other point is not only can we measure it, but we can improve with training. So it wouldn't necessarily be helpful for me to come here and say, everybody can tell when you're not confident. All right, now go out and give presentations. Too bad for you. The idea here is that there is a good takeaway, which is that we can measure what the cues are that people attend to figure out confidence, and we can improve that with training. So we can learn the skills necessary to improve our performance in speaking. And if I sound a little distracted, it's because I'm balancing, moving back and forth to make sure that I actually have the slides updating here. So the takeaway here is that presentation skills matter. Presentation skills and confidence affect speaker believability and audience confidence in what's said. And the better your presentation skills, the easier your presentations will go. Again, we can improve communication skills with training and practice. And I think this is important because you have an important message in particular. There's plenty of people who have messages that it doesn't really matter if they have the presentation skills or not. You all have some very important information that you're communicating to the public. And so I think it's very important that you be able to communicate it in the most effective way possible. So that's the main takeaway on the research. If there are any questions on that, I'll take a second here and pause for them, and then we'll move on to an overview.
Sure. We did have one question that came in specifically looking for examples, Taylor, of nonverbal skills to communicate confidence.
Ah, okay, so this is an excellent one. There are nonverbal skills that communicate confidence that are culturally informed. And I think this is a really important point to make. So different cultures have different communication styles that are expected and that are conditioned. And sometimes there's conflict or perceptions of poor communication in part because of these. And so an example that I'll give is eye contact. So we'll talk about this a little bit more in the presentation skills part, but in general, in North America, and like sort of mainstream American culture, as vague as I can be about this, especially among people from sort of Northern European backgrounds, so that's Anglo and Germanic and whatever else, there's an expectation that eye contact is an indicator of trustworthiness and honesty. And so making direct eye contact, for instance, or, you know, when you're managing a room, looking out at a room, 30 people, 300 people, it doesn't matter, being able to scan the room and look like you're actually looking at people rather than at your hands or at your notes is something that communicates confidence. It's a nonverbal marker. And we'll talk a lot more about these in the presentation skills, but posture is another one. There's a number of ways that we can look at this, but the key takeaway here is that people are not just listening to the words that you say, but they're also looking at how you're presenting those words. So right now, I'm lucky in that none of you can see me, I assume. So I'm, you know, I'm sitting comfortably in a room in California. But if I'm standing in front of a room, one of the things that I'll manage is how I'm standing, where I'm standing, and how I'm delivering the information. And we'll get a lot more into that in the next section. Were there any other questions?
Not at this time, but I'll remind the audience that they can continue to submit their questions and comments using that Q&A window at any time. We'll break again shortly.
All right. Excellent. All right, so moving on to an overview of presentation skills. So the presentation competencies can be divided a number of different ways. There's content management, visual aids, platform skills, and participant management. Those are the core four. And you can divide it up in different ways if you want, but those are what I think of as the core four competencies for presentations. I realized just a moment ago, I'm going to interrupt myself, that Gene mentioned a possible noise distraction from my end, and I never actually followed up on that and verified what it would be. So I'm last time I gave this presentation, it was a webinar from the ICF offices in New York City on Wall Street. This time, I am on a naval base, and so there is the slight possibility of a fighter jet flyover. So if anybody hears a very loud noise, it should be over fast, but there is the possibility of that, and I wanted to give everybody a heads up before I forget. I'll treat that as managing the room and managing the technology, and we can talk about that later as well. So that said, I want to get back into the presentation competencies. So first is content management, and here we go. So the first thing to ask yourself is, what is the key point of your talk? And what do people need to know to understand that point? And a very, very important question here is, how can people go astray? So a lot of times we think about what it is that we want to communicate. We think about the point of our talk, and we just kind of organize, well, here's how I'm going to say what I'm going to say. But a very important exercise is thinking, what are the ways that people can misunderstand this? What are the ways that people can get this wrong? And what are the trickiest points where you can start to lose people? And you can start to build a presentation around those so you have an idea of the general flow of a presentation based on what do I need to say? How's the most effective way to organize this material so I can communicate it effectively? But then also you really want to focus on the key points where people can get lost, because that can totally sink a presentation. And what I will say is, it helps to have friends who maybe don't know, or colleagues who don't know the material that you're going to present, and ask them, one, for help, just to ask questions when you practice your presentation, but two, ask them to come up with the weirdest questions that they can, with the most off-the-wall questions. So I'm lucky to have had married into a family where I have a broadcast journalist who I can go to with these questions, and he has been asked completely ridiculous questions or heard completely ridiculous statements for years and years and years. So I can go to him with a presentation and give a practice talk, or, you know, summarize the key points, and he will come back at me with a handful of just off-the-wall, bonkers questions. And more often than not, I'll get one of them in the actual talk, and I'm then well prepared for it. So you want to think about the ways that people can go astray, not because the expectation is that you will do anything wrong or that you'll give a bad presentation, but rather because there's always going to be that one person, and maybe they voice it, maybe they don't. There'll be that one person who fixates on the wrong minor detail, or who asks a question where it's just off the wall. And the more comfortable you are with that, the easier it is to really manage the room. Now, content management starts with basic organization. You want to introduce the topic, and you'll notice the first thing that I did in this presentation was introduce the topic, give an overview of what we're going to do, and then move on. So I provide a motivation. That was the research in this case. What does the research say about presentation skills? Why is this important to you? Then describe the necessary context. And then you'll explain the research question or the point that you want to make. And then lay out the data analysis and strategy. So that's the actual nitty-gritty of how do I get from point A to point B to point C in my presentation. And what I will say is, it always helps to have a high-level overview. So, for instance, I have a ton of research in linguistics. Some of it is on topics. Often it's on topics where there are people who are interested in the general subject, but nobody's done that specific detailed piece of it. And so the thing to remember for you all is that you are the experts here. You know way more than your audience does. That's the point of this kind of presentation. And so you'll want to think about how you can give them a roadmap at the beginning, so they know where we're going, and they know how what you're saying fits into the broader context. So to give an example, I gave a talk recently on the morphosyntax of Zulu. It's a Bantu language spoken in South Africa. And it's a talk where I expected that most of the audience was familiar with the basic linguistic tools that I use. So they're familiar with morphology, they're familiar with phonology, they might be familiar with the language, they might not. But the general idea is that I started with, I am going to make the argument that X, Y, and Z. I'm going to do that by saying, with using the tools from, you know, A, B, and C. And then the ultimate point that we're going to get to that I'm trying to convince you of is X. It doesn't really matter what the details are here, but the general idea is that you want to lay out, this is what I'm going to say, these are the tools I'm going to use to do it, and this is the argument that I'm going to make. So then, in the middle of your presentation, when you're deep in the weeds of it, people can actually think about, okay, I know where this is going, I understand why this person is telling me this. And this works for everything, so I'm expecting for the presentations that you're giving, in general, the audience may not be all that knowledgeable about the material that you're delivering, but if you give them a roadmap, then they're much more likely to follow you through the twists and turns of the actual case that you're making. So, continuing with that, there's a number of different ways that you can organize things. You can document findings, for instance, point by point, or just lay out the necessary pieces to make your argument. So you don't necessarily have to have, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You can go from A to C to G, skipping some of the other stuff in between, if people know that there is that stuff in between, and that you're leaving out the necessary pieces to make your argument and to fit it into the appropriate time frame. And I will say that giving a 20-minute conference talk, is a very different beast than giving, a 2-hour webinar or a 6-hour talk to, 300 people. It really, really depends on what the actual context of the presentation is. But it's the same general idea that you have time to document the findings. You want it organized in a way where they can follow along, where they know where they are. And at each section, you'll maybe stop and say, so we started here. I said I was going to say this. Then you say the whole thing. You say, I said this. Now we're moving on to the next section because that sets us up for the next thing. You want to keep holding people's hands as you go through because not everybody necessarily is going to follow every single step, and it helps get people back on track. Now, what I can say also is that you can provide comments to explain findings or implications of the argument as well. So once you make a point, you can rephrase it. You can cycle back and provide context. But the idea here is that you are guiding people through learning the material that you are presenting to them. And you only have a set amount of time to do it. And lastly, what I will say is at the end of each section, whatever the sections may be, if it's key points in an argument or if it's bigger sections in a larger presentation, you should wrap up and say, I said I was going to say this. I have said this. And now that feeds into the next piece. And then you tie everything together when you're done. So a couple more points before I move on to visual aids. One is that there's a ton of variety in styles. So some people use a full-blown guide with notes pages. Some people use notes pages in PowerPoint for themselves, which I'm sort of doing right now. Others use handwritten notes. Some people may organize things in terms of mind maps or flashcards. So you have a bunch of different styles for content management and for how you choose to manage the content that you're going to present. And what I would say is think about whatever works best for you, whatever you're most comfortable with, and what you can get away with in the context of the talk that you're giving. So flashcards are often very helpful for people, but there's some talks where you don't want to give them. Another thing that's a problem area that you should identify in the content before you give the talk is think about hot issues with a particular group. Think about hot button issues, things that are likely to get people riled up. And you want to be aware of where people may be upset so that you can head that off from the beginning. Another is areas that call for policy decisions that you're not able to make. You want to know, how will I respond to these questions? Just have a response prepared. Another is internal or external political issues that could create drama in the room. So depending on what you're talking about, there may be strong feelings about it, and you want to be aware of what those might be. so that you can then be prepared for what may happen in the room. So, you know, if your content is likely to push people's buttons, you want to be aware of that and be ready to deal with what buttons get pushed. And again, I am saying this from the perspective of someone who does a lot of facilitation work around diversity and inclusion and around unconscious bias. So I'm used to materials that's often very sensitive and very hot button. And I will say, hopefully for all of you, it's a little bit less fraught, although, you know, who knows. So that said, I want to move on to visual aids. And this is a very important part of presentations that I think is often overlooked, because we all have access to PowerPoint or pages or something, but we don't necessarily all have any training on it or spend a lot of time reflecting on best practices for PowerPoint and for presentations. And so there's a wide range of things that people do. And sometimes they're fantastic and sometimes they're really not. So what I will say is that effective speakers prepare visuals that are legible, that's readable to the audience, that are clearly related to the content being presented, so not just, you know, off-the-wall materials. And I'll give an example of that. There's a professional linguist I know who's brilliant, does fantastic research, but who really took kind of a hit at a conference because the material that they presented was excellent, but the slides all had pictures of kittens and, you know, pictures from TV shows that they liked, and it was examples that were only tangentially relevant and seemed just very, very cutesy and really affected how the audience interpreted this person's work. So I'll say, you know, you want to make sure that it's clearly related to the content being presented. That's not to say don't ever use kittens and don't ever use pictures from TV and whatever. I use pictures from Star Trek every now and then, but I know exactly how they're going to land, and there's only, you know, one slide with those pictures. So if you're ever in doubt, maybe, you know, hold off on including pictures that are fun or cute or whatever. I will also say that visual aids should be organized and consistently formatted. And the consistent formatting is something that, in your case, is going to be a little bit easier because you have specific formatting guidelines, which I think are good guidelines. So as you build your slideshows, for instance, you can look at the EPA slides and the NARPM slides and build your slide decks based on those criteria. And those are specifically designed to make your slides legible and readable and consistently formatted. So that is ideal. Now, moving on, effective speakers will manage their visual aids by testing equipment first and having contingency plans, positioning the body to avoid blocking participants' view, and that's a big one, and speaking to participants rather than to the visual aid, that's another big one. So testing equipment and having contingency plans is hugely, hugely, hugely important. You want to be prepared. So for this, we did a run-through, I think, a month and a half ago, and then followed up with testing before each of these sessions. And the general idea is you don't necessarily always know when you're presenting in a new place what's going to be available to you, what's going to actually work, when you'll have access to the room, all of these things. So you want to make sure that you have a contingency plan. In my case, I can give this talk without the slides if need be. And in general, any of the talks that I give, I can talk for however long I need to without the slides and the visual aids. They help immensely. And what I will say is if you know that there's a possibility that you won't have visual aids and that you want something like that, and if it's a possibility to do this, then you can also print things out. So often, for a lot of our government clients, they'll have a printed version of the slide deck in their hands that they can look at, or it'll be circulated before the event. Or in some way, people have access to the visual aids, even if there's some catastrophic issue with the original plan. With regards to positioning the body, in general, you're not going to stand directly in front of your slides because when they're projected, it's just not fun. to do that. You have the actual projection in your eyes. But you want to think about where people are in the room and where you are and if you were blocking their view. So often, if there's a large screen that I have slides projected on, I will stand to the side of that screen on one side or the other. Sometimes there's a lectern. If you have a lectern, you're lucky. You just stand behind the lectern and you're great. But if not, you want to manage where you are in the room and make sure that people can see. And if people can't see, if it's a lose-lose situation, then you may want to move around as best as you can in order to enable the maximum number of people to see for the maximum amount of time. Lastly, you want to speak to the participants rather than the visual aid. So that's where this eye contact comes in. That doesn't mean pick one person in the room and stare them down. That would be a very bad strategy. But in general, you'll scan the room. You want to look at the audience. That also doesn't mean that you don't look at your slides or you don't look at your notes or anything. But the general rule of thumb is you want to spend as much time as possible actually looking at the participants rather than looking at your visual aids or looking at your hands. And definitely do not turn and face your slides and read them aloud, in part because nobody will be able to hear you, and in part because it's just a bad presentation that way. So here I'm going to move into what makes a slide bad versus what makes a slide good. And we have two slides here. I'm not going to put up there we go. We have a survey and vote. So you can all comment on what makes this slide bad. I have two slides for you here from notoriously bad slide makers. And I'm going to let you all discuss, and then we'll tie this all together. So here's one bad slide on how rivers are formed. And I would love some feedback on what you think makes this a bad slide.
And so I'll just remind the audience that there's a new window that's popped up in the bottom left corner where you can type in a short text response, and then you can scroll through some of the other responses coming in. If you can't see that window because you're on a mobile device, you can send in your own response via the Q&A window that you should still have access to on the mobile device, and we'll be happy to incorporate that. So, Taylor, I'm seeing lots of comments coming into that space.
So am I. So these are all excellent comments as well. Too much text is the first point, and this is a really important point. So academics in particular, scientists, researchers, engineers, we all tend to, as a group, have a very, very bad habit of putting way too much text on a slide. And oftentimes, you'll see people who have effectively just written a paper on the subject and then divided the sentences into bullet points. This is, we'll put it charitably, this is an ineffective strategy for giving a good presentation. If your goal is to have some form of the material that you can just circulate, then you might as well just have bullet points as a separate document that you can give people. It makes for terrible slides. Another point is that the image is directly behind the writing. And so the writing is, first of all, there's a lot of it. It is small. And then it's made much harder to read by the fact that it's superimposed on an image. The image is relevant, sort of. It gives a background to the idea that we're talking about how rivers are formed. But it doesn't really add anything of use to the presentation. And it makes the actual text very, very hard to read. A third point is that with the text over the image, as many of you pointed out, the text is not a good color. So having white text on a light blue or a light green image is not readable. So to the extent that you're going to use images in your slides, which I do think is a good strategy sometimes, what I will say is it helps to either have the image on one side and the text on another, and preferably as little text as possible, or to have the image on its own slide and another slide for your text. The other thing that I'll say is that this kind of bullet point is far, far too much information. And one of the things that helps me is to think about slides as effectively flashcards. They're mnemonics for me to talk about specific points. And there are specific bullets that people can hang the rest of the talk off of. So as I'm talking, you'll see, I have one sentence or I have one word that's tied to what I'm saying. and it can remind the audience what I'm on about if they drift off for a second and come back. But then also, it's a much, much easier way of organizing a presentation. Now, I will say that it depends also on what the context is for the presentation that you're giving. So I do a lot of facilitation around diversity and inclusion, as I mentioned before, and this is something where we have our own proprietary materials. So another reason for this is I will have sort of a flashcard way of doing things, in part so that when we give our slides to clients, they can't necessarily rebuild the whole presentation from our slides alone. That should not be a concern for all of you, so you know you don't have to have very, very vague bullet points that you then explain in the room, but you want to balance something in between that end of the spectrum where you have an individual word that's mysterious until you explain it, which is a good way of hooking people's interest. You want to balance that and having just an entire novel or report written on a slide. And a general rule of thumb is anything from individual words to a short sentence. But even just clauses, I think, are fine if they're interpretable. So I have one more bad slide for you. We'll ask what makes this slide bad. And this is actually one of the, it's agreed to be one of the worst slides ever made. And it was made for the Pentagon, who are notorious for having terrible slides. As he can't read it in all caps, competing importance and topics. These are all good. Too much information, too busy. And there's all spaghetti in there as well. So exactly, you're all correct on this. The sad thing about this is that this is clearly something that's built by experts who know an enormous amount of material. They're doing their best to organize it so it's color-coded, you know, things that are relevant to one thing are tied to another thing. But ultimately, it's not organized in a way that's readable. This individual slide could probably be its own hour-long presentation. And, you know, each of the color-coded sections could potentially be their own sections in a talk. And all of the I actually have no idea why I have all of these ties, because it looks like everything is directly related to everything else, in which case there's no need to have these links anyway. But the idea here is that this is a very bad slide. Now, you'll notice in making my slides about bad slides, I have followed the EPA and NARPM slide guidelines. So I have my title at the top. I have the banner at the bottom, the actual slide formatting, so that you know this is a coherent part of the same presentation. And then I have my image in the middle. The image just happens to be an image of a terrible slide. But even here, I'm keeping to the idea of, you know, one image per slide. I've put these on their own slides rather than having text next to them explaining it, which I assume you're all thankful for, because this would be an absolutely awful slide if I even change it in that way, trying to include a bad slide, it would still be unreadable. So you want to think about the material that you have as well. Even if you are including images, you know, how much can people get out of what they're looking at here, and how much is just overwhelming. So moving on from the bad slides, I want to talk about other technology. And there's plenty more that we can say about slides, but what I will say to just tie a bow on that is the general idea here is, you know, follow the template that you have. You should all have access to this template, and if you don't have access, you can ask how to get access to it. It is a good template. It is sometimes frustrating because there's, you know, an argument that you should have no more than, I think, 6 or 7 bullet points, so you'll split things across slides. But follow that template because it will make your presentation understandable and readable and usable for the people that you're actually presenting the information to. And I think if there's one point that you get out of this whole presentation, it's going to be to think about the audience experience in your talk. Too often it's very easy for us to think, I need to communicate this information, it's very important information, and what's the best way for me to just do a brain dump? And that's not at all useful for the audience, usually, because in general, the expert knows way too much stuff. And so those of us who don't know the material that you're going to be presenting, we really need our hands held. And we need that in a variety of ways. So if you tell me I'm going to make these claims, this is what we're talking about, this is why, here's how I'm going to do it, and then each step of the way say, I told you I was going to do this and I did this, I told you I was going to do that and I did that, and you have clear visuals, simple slides that are readable and not too much stuff, so I'm not overwhelmed by looking at it, it's going to be a much, much better experience, both for the audience, but then also for the presenter. And I think the main reason we get stressed out as presenters is, whether we're aware of it or not, is this fear of losing the audience. And so if we make everything easy for the audience and they know we're doing our best to make it easy for them, then in general, the audience is going to go with you. You won't have a problem. Where you start to see problems is when the audience feels like you don't care or you're not being clear or whatever. So each of these ideas ties back to just make it as simple as possible for the people in the room to understand what you're saying. And, you know, if you can make it simpler, make it simpler. Even if you think this is already pretty simple, make it simpler. So moving on to other technology, what I will say is arrive early and find your point of contact for tech, if there is a point of contact. This is hugely important. So if you do not arrive early, more often than not, you will find that there is some technological problem that needed to be solved in advance. And that was a minor problem, but that can create problems for your presentation that can either cut into your time or, you know, have you lose an audience effectively because you weren't ready at the start time and they're there waiting for you. So I was recently traveling. Actually, I've been traveling almost nonstop for the last month or two giving talks. And one of the talks that I gave recently at a tech point of contact, I showed up an hour in advance, which is what I usually do when it's a first day in a new place, and maybe a half hour in advance when I'm more comfortable with the location or where I know they have a lot of talks and they've already started and everything's sorted out. But I showed up an hour in advance and found that the room that the presentation was supposed to be in had been given to somebody else, and that the person who could authorize changing the room was out of the office. And there's all of these different factors that happen. And so, you know, it thankfully worked out just fine. But once you get the room, we found, well, the slides weren't loaded. And once the slides were loaded, we found, well, the audio's not working. And so you want to leave yourself time to troubleshoot all these issues, or preferably have somebody else troubleshoot all these issues. But leave yourself time so that you know that when it comes time to talk, you're good. You give your 20-minute talk, you give your hour long, it doesn't matter, you're ready, and you start on time. And what I will say is that it is very important in keeping an audience on your side, especially if you're going to be evaluated later, that you start on time and that you end on time or end early. And I will make a promise to you all right now that I will absolutely end on time, if not a little bit early, since I know some of you are probably dying to get back to work if you're not the vacationer type here. So arrive early and find your point of contact. And then you'll test the microphone setup if it's present. And if it is present, use it. Don't assume everyone can hear you. I can't tell you how many talks I've been at where somebody says, I don't want to use the microphone. I assume everyone can hear me. Can you hear me in the back? And somebody in the back says no, and they don't hear the response from the back, and they just keep talking. You lose audience members very quickly. The other thing that I will say is this is a question of including people as well. So there are people who have disabilities, for instance. Within the naval context, there's tons of people who have targeted disabilities like hearing loss. And that's something that people maybe will be a little bit reluctant to tell you. Or maybe they think, well, I can sort of figure it out. But what you don't want is people in the room trying to read your lips or whatever else if you could have just made it easy for them. So if there is a lapel mic, take the lapel mic. If there's a handheld, take the handheld. If there's a lectern with a microphone, then do your best to speak into the microphone and, you know, try not to hit it when gesturing, which always happens. But in general, if there's a microphone, use it, because that technology is there specifically for the audience. And frankly, people will tell you that they can hear you, but invariably at some point your voice is going to dip and people are going to lose you. So I can't reiterate this enough. If you have technology there that's going to make it more inclusive for people, And I see we have closed captioning here. I think that's an excellent use as well. If you have technology that is going to make it more inclusive for people, use that technology, even if it's a mild annoyance. The other thing that I'll say specifically about microphones and specifically about handheld microphones is it takes away a different problem, which is what do I do with my hands? If you have a microphone in your hand, you have that problem halfway solved. It gives you something to do. So if you're nervous about presentations, that can also take away some of the nerves. And it's a very, very easy tool to help you and help everyone else. So now we're getting on to the real meat of this, which is the basics on platform skills. I have this divided into six sections. I'm sure we could think of more if we wanted to, but these are going to be prior preparation, posture and movement, breathing, speed and pacing, asking questions, and answering questions. And these are all important parts of the presentation. So prior preparation, the first thing you want to know is there a preferred format? In your case, you already know that. The answer is yes, you will follow it. The second is, what is your time frame for providing secondary materials? So that's slides, that's your poster. You just want to be prepared and know when you need to have things in, when you need to have things done. And I apologize, I'm having a little technical glitch here. There we go. All right. So those are important points. You want to make sure that you have the technology sorted out and that you know when you need to have things submitted, what the format needs to be. And again, in your case, you should all know already when things are due, and you already should know the format. If you don't know the format, ask somebody. You will find out. The next part with prior preparation is to decide if you want or need a script. Some people feel very comfortable just speaking extemporaneously. If you know the material inside and out, you know the argument you want to make, then you're confident that you can do it without a script. The danger there is that you can either lose your train of thought or you can lose track of time. So especially with people who are experts in their subject matter, it's very easy if you have a 20-minute talk to go 30 minutes, 40 minutes, whatever, just because you get bogged down in the organization and you haven't practiced. So if you need a script, absolutely prepare a script. One of my colleagues at CulturePoint has every talk just fully scripted. It doesn't matter how long it is. If it's a six-hour talk, they have a script memorized. They can diverge from the script. They can improvise when the room throws them curveballs. But in general, they have a script, and they know word for word what they're going to say each time. I'm a little bit different, as I'm sure you've noticed. I'll go off on a couple of tangents here and there. But the general idea is you want to know exactly how much time you have and that you can cover all the material that you need to cover within the time that you have. And so then there's different ways that you can do that. Practice is one. I will say practice. I know that for a lot of you, you know, you're not necessarily thinking of yourselves as presenters first and foremost. It's not your job. It's just a part of your job. But practice is hugely important. So if you need to time yourself, then time yourself. But as I mentioned before, nobody likes going over time, and it's very, very easy for speakers to run over if they aren't keeping track of where they are in their presentation and how long it's going to take to get from point A to point B. And like I said, again, brainstorm possible questions. Don't focus only on the smart questions, because more often than not, nobody's going to ask you the smart questions. They're going to ask you either the gotcha questions, if it's a contentious issue or if it's a room full of academics, or they're going to ask you just weird questions where they missed something, they misinterpreted a word. You know, if you use jargon that you didn't necessarily explain well, then invariably somebody's going to misunderstand what the word means and go off on some bizarre tangent based on their unique interpretation of one word that you used. So you want to be prepared for ways it can go left in advance. And I keep giving the impression, I think, that, you know, audiences are going to be really off the wall. But I, in general, you know, 99% of talks that people give are going to be to audiences that are, you know, polite and quiet, and maybe they ask one or two questions that you're prepared for and you're good. It's that 1% that you want to be ready for, because when it happens, it can be rough. I will also say, actually, before I move on to the platform skills and actually managing the room and talking, are there any questions on the material that I've covered so far?
There are. So we might pause here
Okay,
for
I figured
a
there
minute
would
or
be.
two.
Let's pause here.
So one of the participants asked how you feel about alternative web-based presentation formats, for example, Prezi, rather than using software like PowerPoint.
I don't actually have feelings at all. and the way that I look at it is these are all tools. So if you believe that it's the right tool for the audience and that they'll be able to make use of that tool, then I'd say absolutely go for it. And I've seen a variety of different presentation styles. It's just a matter of what will work for you and what will best communicate to the audience. So, you know, I'm very used to standing and talking in a room, but right now I'm doing an Adobe Connects webinar because that was what works for the organization. And, you know, this is still a relatively new world to me, the webinar world, but mm-hmm. it's something that it's just all tools. It's a question of how do you best communicate the information to the audience that you have.
Okay, another question. what's a good way to avoid answering a question that you don't want to answer mm-hmm. in front of a live audience?
I think, so I'll touch on this a little bit later as well, but I think that's a fantastic question. There are a number of different ways that you can do that. But one that I'll say, don't be shy to just say, that's something that I would be glad to discuss further with you offline or after the presentation. So there are sometimes very pointed questions that people ask. There are sometimes questions that get into legal issues or political issues, and don't be afraid to say, thank you for your question. That's not something that I can address at this moment, and I would love to discuss this with you after the presentation. Or if you actually just cannot answer it for legal reasons or otherwise, you know, thank you for your question. That's not something that I can answer at this time. And, you know, the person who asked it may be upset, but that's a much better way of handling the room. What I will say is don't get hooked. So don't get if somebody has a contentious question or a contentious remark, you're still in charge of the room, and you don't have to let that person hook you and drag you into a conversation that you don't want to have with a room full of people who maybe also don't really want to have that conversation.
Right. When it gets into the visuals, you had talked a lot about what they might use visually on the screen or in the room. We have some questions about physical handouts. Someone wanted to know if you would suggest providing worksheets where the participants are asked to write, take notes, complete activities, or is that something that would just be distracting to them and take their attention away from you as the speaker?
So you'll notice a theme in my responses, which is it depends on the audience and the presentation. And I think you will all have a better feel for what your audience is. But in general, I don't in principle think that that's a bad idea. It just depends. So, for instance, I'm going to give a talk later this afternoon, and they will all have handouts with all the slides. They have, I think, three slides per page, and then a little side on the sheet next to the slide with room for them to take notes. And for this particular audience, so this is Navy senior leaders, it's primarily captains and commanders, they really like having that room to take notes. Worksheets with specific questions, I'm not sure. People may feel like that's homework, but it really depends on the audience. So I know there's some academic linguistic conferences where people would love that. It mm-hmm. just really depends. In general, if you have the ability to give handouts, I always lean a little bit in favor of them, as well as slides, just because it allows people something that they can take notes on, something they can take home, something that they can think about. But again, it depends on whether or not it's something that you want people to be able to take home. So just keep that in mind.
Okay. And this one
anything
actually,
else before I move on?
One more question. We'll take this one about non-engaged attendees. And I know I have personally run into this situation myself. How do you deal with the non-engaged people, people who are checking their email or looking at their phone?
Yeah.
Do you call them out? Do you just ignore them? Is it my failure as a speaker to keep them engaged? What do I do?
It's easy to spiral psychologically in the front of the room when you see that. So again, it does depend on the audience. What I will say is, if I am, I'll give you a couple of different scenarios. So if I'm teaching, if I'm an invited speaker and I'm teaching in a classroom, for instance, then I may call people out for, looking at their cell phones or whatever. And I'll do it in a way where I'll say, I'm not necessarily going to chew somebody out and say, put your phone away or whatever, but especially if it's something where they're not obligated to be there, I'll say, please feel free to have your phone conversation somewhere else. Again, like I said, there's the volunteers, there's the vacationers, and there's the hostages. And I recently had 4 excruciating days of 2 3-hour talks a day where those 8 talks were effectively just all hostages in a toxic work environment. And I addressed that directly, head on, and that actually really helps get the room on your side to say, I know that you were are required to be here. I know that many of you don't want to be here. And I know that, for those of you who are required to be here and don't want to be here, you have another job that you want to get back to, and I will do my best to get you back to that. But in the meantime, I have been contracted to be here. You were required to be here. And I mentioned that I prefer presentations to be interactive, so I'm going to be asking you all questions. This is going to go a lot better for you all and a lot better for me if we just get through this together. The last thing that I will say is, in general, in any talk that I give, there will be people who nod off or who check their phones or whatever, and it's not because the talk is not engaging. In fact, sometimes those people will come up and say, I really enjoyed your talk. It's just different people have different things going on. So, for instance, the talk that I'm going to give this afternoon, I know it's right after lunch. And I know it's a warm, windowless room. And so I will give frequent breaks. And I will also make sure that I try and keep it as engaging as possible, keep the level of energy up. But, if there's one person in the room who is distracted, I would say don't pay them too much mind. If the entire room looks checked out, then you want to start to manage that. And you can decide if you want to just up the energy, if you want to give everybody a break, depending on how long the talk is. If you have a 20-minute talk, then it doesn't make sense to give people a 5-minute break. Just get through it. But ultimately, you are responsible for the energy in the room, but you can address it head on. You can say to people, all right, so, if you don't want to be here, or if you have other things that you're trying to do right now, then please, if you aren't required to be here, please step out. If you are required to be here, then you need to cut it out. And let's get through this together. But keep in mind, I'm here to do my job. I will not waste your time. Do not waste mine. So that's from like the most relaxed to the most stern. But if you really need to address it, then address it. You're in charge.
Okay,
And we'll talk a little
excellent.
bit
Thank
more
you.
about this. Actually, a pretty good transition into the next segment here. So
All right.
that's all right. I'm going to move on to the platform skills, which is the real meat of the presentation here. So I'd say effective speakers will manage nerves. You want to transform that into positive energy. And transform is kind of a weird word here because everybody gets nervous before giving presentations. So if you get nervous before giving presentations, there's nothing wrong with you. It's completely normal. It's completely natural, and everybody does it no matter how many times they've given the talk. So what I will say is the most effective reaction to your own nervousness is to remember to breathe. And you want to stay centered, try and feel the floor underneath your feet if you're standing during the presentation, and breathe. So it's that, and to remember that everybody gets nervous, and this nervous energy is something that you can use if you just remember that it's there to help you effectively. So there's a fantastic book called How Emotions Are Made, and one of the things that they really hammer home in that book is that the neuroscience is pretty clear that part of how we feel, how we make emotions, is we recruit information from our sort of physical experience of our body and the world, but it's ambiguous information. So the exact same physiological patterns may be interpreted as one thing by one person and as another by another person, meaning nervous energy can be excitement to give a good talk and looking forward to the talk and all this instead of, looming terror. So remember that your body is just preparing you for a talk, for something new, and remember to breathe, and you can keep yourself calm. But don't try and just force yourself to be calm if you're not calm. Recognize it is there to help you. Voice is the next, and what I will say is volume, pace, and intonation are important. Those are things that we discussed with the research. So what your volume is, how quickly you speak, and the rise and fall of your intonation and your pitch is important. It's something to keep in mind. I have the habit, like many people, of speaking more quickly when I'm excited. And one of the things that a person who coached me a lot on facilitation reiterates over and over again is to speak slowly. She actually gave me a mental reminder for myself, which is just to think of Maya Angelou. And I don't know if any of you have heard Maya Angelou give interviews, but she sounds like she's savoring every word that she says. And so I think it's an extreme example, but I need to keep that extreme in mind to balance my own other extreme and whatever works for you. But remember that you want to speak as clearly as possible. Again, just because you know the information doesn't mean that everybody else does. And I think a lot of times we think, oh, this may be boring to people, so let me just get through it quickly. And then you start to zip through material that everybody would benefit from hearing slowly. Lastly, volume is important, especially if you don't have a microphone. Then you want to really figure out, okay, how do I manage making sure that everybody can hear me? And if you keep your pitch low but your volume up, if you can keep relaxed, if you can breathe and speak slowly, then you also preserve your voice pretty well. Eye contact, I mentioned earlier in response to one of the questions. Actually, I want to go back to voice because this reminded me of something. So I did some facilitation work last month, and we had everybody divide into groups, and they had to work on projects together, and then they had to present what they had done to the rest of the groups at the end of the day. And invariably, everybody would say when we handed them the microphone, well, I don't want to use this because I don't like how my voice sounds. And what I will say is that it is important to remember, especially when you hear yourself played back, if you hear it on a microphone, if you hear, say, a recorded webinar, it's important to remember that when we hear our own voices, we have the little voice that we have in our head that we think of as ours, and we have the voice that we hear when we're speaking, but we're hearing that differently than everybody else. And so when you hear a recording, it may be the first time that you hear how you sound to everybody else, and it's uncanny. It's a little weird. So everybody hates how they sound on recordings, generally, unless they're, trained singers and speakers and whatever else. But that's because, in part, as you're speaking, your vocal cords are vibrating, and your skull is vibrating, and your jaw is vibrating, and you're hearing it both from sound waves out in the air and also from reverberations in your physical body. And so when you hear a recording, you don't have those reverberations in your physical body, and it sounds weird. But the key thing to keep in mind is everybody else is already used to how you sound. You don't actually sound weird. And it's completely normal for us to have this reaction to how we sound, but that doesn't mean that we should not use the microphone and make it difficult for people to hear. The key thing to remember, to keep in the back of your mind, is if you're using a microphone, if you hear yourself recorded, you are going to sound different. There's nothing wrong with it, and nobody actually cares. You're the only person who does, and that's just because you've got this thing going on with reverberations in your head. So there's a little tangent there, but I think it's important because everybody has this feeling, and so when you hand somebody a mic, they go, I don't want to use it. It's again, microphones are probably the best way. If you have access, they're the best way to make sure that everybody is included and can actually hear you, even if it sounds weird to you. So moving on from that, eye contact, we discussed a little bit before. What I will say is that range and focus is that's the two points that are important here. So you want to just sort of scan the room. You can look from person to person if you want, but like I said before, don't just pick one person and stare them down. And a very important point is if you were talking about something contentious, if you were talking about something that involves protected groups, if you were talking about something that involves groups of people that are in any way sort of socially evaluated, you want to make sure that you don't inadvertently, you know, stare at a person who is in the group that you're talking about. So especially, like I said, this diversity and inclusion work is where this stuff gets really contentious. But if I want to say, you know, if I want to talk about stereotypes, then it is very important that if I'm talking about stereotypes about Group X, I don't inadvertently stare at somebody from Group X while I'm talking about those stereotypes, because it could be perceived as, you know, isn't this right? Don't you know this to be true? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it can also be perceived as, I hold these stereotypes and I'm staring at you now, or I'm focusing the rest of the room on you now. So you want to be careful about, you know, if you're talking about groups, you don't want to just stare somebody down from that group. But in general, there's two ways that you can do this. One is look from person to person. And the other is just sort of scan the room. You don't have to make eye contact with everybody. You just be looking out at different segments of the room. If you're looking person to person, do not be upset when you have that one person who has their head down or who looks a little sleepy or, you know, who looks distracted. It's fine. Just move on. The last part is body. So posture, stance, and movement. And there's a lot there. What I will say is, this is where I'm going to make one joke, and we'll talk about jokes a little bit later. You want to be sure that a joke is going to land if you do make a joke. So hopefully this one does. I won't hear you all laugh. But there's a joke that is in my field. I heard about linguists. I heard about engineers as well. And the question is, how do you tell the outgoing linguist? And the answer is, they're the one who's staring at your shoes rather than their own. Now, again, you're all muted, so I assume somebody laughed, I hope. But if you do tell a joke, you want to pause for it. All right, there we go. That's what I was hoping for. You know, give a second for it. And the idea there is that there's a stereotype about researchers in particular that we stare at our shoes or that we, you know, don't make eye contact. You want to be engaging the audience. And this maybe more or less work for you depending on your personal preferences. So for some of us, it's very hard. It just then is part of the job and not a personal shortcoming. Okay, so if you are one of those people who has a hard time making eye contact, that's fine. But if you're given a 20-minute talk to an audience, then your job for that 20 minutes is in part to keep them engaged. And if you think about it that way, it's a lot easier to not beat yourself up about it because you're just doing a job. You show up, you do the job, you go home, and you stare at your feet or whatever you need to do. And the other thing that I'll say is that silence is your friend. So if you think about communicating in a noisy channel, you want to not talk too fast. You want to make time, enunciate, and don't be afraid to repeat yourself or to cycle back. Make a point. You can say it again. You can say it three times. It's helpful for the audience, and it's helpful to leave some time for people to process. So with the posture, you want to stand straight, both feet on the floor. When you move, move with purpose, and avoid shifting from side to side. So I know one person who, when giving presentations, will always shift their weight from left foot to right foot to left foot to right foot, and they end up looking like a metronome going back and forth in front of the room, and it is wildly distracting. This doesn't mean don't move. This doesn't mean don't make yourself comfortable. But if you have habits like that, it helps to be aware of them. And again, to just think of it as, this is my job for the next however long to manage that, to manage eye contact. So it's more than just the content of the presentation. It's also how you stand in front of the room. Another thing that has been demonstrated to help with confidence is power stances. So, you know, a power stance, even before the presentation, you know, that's standing feet planted wide, you know, hands on your hips, chin up, chest up, you know, eyes forward, that helps with sort of physical embodiment that then helps with confidence for presentations. And the last thing I'll say is don't try to hide from the audience. So when there's a lectern, often people will hide behind the lectern and start to get smaller and smaller and smaller. There was one presentation that I made a mistake, and I learned from my mistake, but I had somebody in the room, it was a very contentious discussion, I had somebody in the room who was what I would think of as friendly fire. Ultimately, we're on the same side, but they had a disagreement about either tactics or some minute point of what I said, and they got very heated. And as they were making their point, I found myself slowly backing away. You were in charge of the room. I realized I was doing this when I hit the wall. But they had to walk forward and answer the question. But you were in charge of the room here. And, you know, don't be shy. Don't hide. It's okay to feel shy. But, again, you were giving a performance effectively. And one of the things to do is to be confident in how you present. And what I mean by be confident is to give off those cues of confidence. So that is to, you know, stand tall, to look out at the room, keep your head up, and, you know, not shrink and dribble behind the lectern or back into the wall or, you know, keep scanning for the nearest exit or whatever. It's very, very rare that you actually give a talk where you need to hide. So, and I think none of you are giving talks like that, so you should be good. So that's 4 points here, and because of our organization of these slides, I'm going to move on to the next slide where I have my remaining three. So that's gestures, language, and your transitions and segues. So gestures, that's hand gestures and facial. That's building on the posture as well. Your gestures should be meaningful. So some of us like to talk with our hands. That is sometimes very helpful. But your gestures should be related to what you're saying and should be meaningful. If you make a point with your hands, it's completely fine. If you don't talk with your hands, that's also fine. So you don't have to really worry about it. I think a lot of times we're very concerned about what do I do with my hands? And the answer is you don't actually have to do anything. What I will say is some of us get into some weird habits. So I have a bottle of water usually when I'm talking. It's excellent for giving pauses in the presentation because you can stop, you can take a sip, and nobody's going to care. You can collect your thoughts. But if I get too excited, I know about myself that I'll pick up the water bottle, I'll talk, I'll unscrew the lid, I'll talk, I'll set the water bottle back down, I'll talk, I'll pick it back up, and it starts to be distracting for the audience because they start thinking, what are they doing with this bottle of water? So if you know that that's you, you want to make sure that you have a plan. But in general, there's literally nothing wrong with just holding your hands normally by your side. I will say don't, you know, put your hands in your pockets at the beginning of a presentation because it seems suspect to people and comes across as either shy or suspect. But in general, if you're worried about your hands, don't be worried. If you gesture with your hands, it's fine. Try and keep it to something related to the talk that you're giving, but you don't actually have to do anything with them. It may feel weird then. You suddenly become aware, like, you know, my arm's just hanging by my side. But we talk like that normally, and it's totally fine. Moving on to language, you want it to be both inclusive and technical. So depending on your audience, you should avoid jargon they're unlikely to understand. What I will say is it helps if you're going to use jargon to define it. And that's even if you expect the audience members to understand, it won't hurt to redefine a term and make sure that everybody's on the same page. And what I'll usually do is I'll stop and I'll define something and I'll then continue where I was. So to go back to my example of talking about Zulu morphosyntax, I made the argument that Zulu can be interpreted or analyzed as having something called construct state. When I did that, I said, okay, I make the claim that Zulu has construct state. Then I immediately turned around and said, as a refresher, construct state is when noun phrases do blah, 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 blah. So, going back, I'm going to make the argument that Zulu has construct state based on the following evidence. So use it, define it. Use it, define it. That's key if you're using technical language. If you can get away with not using jargon and not using technical language but still being understood, then that is ideal. I will also say that swearing is in general a bad idea. It is rare that swearing is a good idea. It does happen. So I gave a talk recently, and it was ensigns in the Navy, and they're in a construction battalion, so the Navy Seabees, and it was the lower enlisted ranks. And they we were doing an exercise where it was brainstorming, and I write what they say. And some of them swore, and they were tickled by the fact that I put up exactly what they said. But it was a context where it's acceptable, and literally it was sailors. So if you are not talking to enlisted sailors, swearing is probably a very bad idea. there are the rare cases where it can help you make a point, but in general, you want to be really certain. Otherwise, just stay away from it. And I think you're all giving scientific talks to the general public, so stay away from swearing. That said, the whole idea here just boils down to just talk to people. It really is that simple. So no flowery language if you can avoid it. Use simple sentences. If you know the material inside and out, you're not going to impress people more by making it overly complicated. If you actually understand what you're saying and you can communicate it effectively to people in simple sentences that are clear and to the point, then everyone will appreciate that. And again, like I said, for technical language, if you have to use it and define it, then repeat. Lastly, so I made a joke a little bit earlier, and I said humor can be a benefit, but it can also be a detriment. You want to be aware of that. So there's a Harvard Business Review study by Evans et al. From 2019 that argues that women may be negatively evaluated for humor, especially if it's self-deprecating humor. So more broadly, men and women are sometimes perceived differently for doing the same behaviors. And in the context of giving a presentation, self-deprecating humor is one where we have evidence, strong evidence, that it doesn't go over well. It can, but in general it doesn't. So same as swearing, you want to be sure when telling a joke that it will land. And if it won't, then just don't make it. Finally, I think this gets us to an important point, which is that depending on who you are going to be read differently by the room. So, women are judged differently than men, whether we like it or not. Black women are judged differently than white women. And the same is true for different categories of men as well. So if you have an idea of how people are likely to interpret you, then you are ahead of the game because you have an idea of how you can tailor your presentation to your strengths. And also, if we're thinking about unconscious bias or if we're thinking about stereotypes, then you can tailor your presentation to circumvent other people's weaknesses in that area. But you just want to make sure that you know what people are likely to think. And you all, I'm certain, already know this about yourselves, what gets you in trouble or what problems other people have that you may have to navigate. Lastly, I have transitions and segues here. I'll say it's important to move smoothly from topic to topic. One of the ways that you do that is by summarizing what you've said. So I've been doing this in this presentation. I'm about to do this again, but I got this in part from a professor at the Wharton School at University of Pennsylvania. He's a professor of statistics. His classes, every class, the first half hour would be a review of what we did the last class, and the last half hour would be a very brief summary of where we were going with it. And it was a mistake to miss the first half hour or the last half hour. But I think the point here is that people do a lot better in following along with the presentation when you say, I'm going to make these claims, I'm going to do it in this way. The first part is to talk about this. You talk about whatever it is you're going to talk about, and then at the end of that section you say, I said I was going to talk about this, I said X, Y, and Z, and that brings us to the next step. And that's exactly what I'm going to do right now and say that I said that I was going to talk about platform skills. We've gone over gestures, language, transitions, humor, posture, your voice, nerves, And now I'm going to move on to answering questions. And now, a quick point is when I say that the presentation is not over, I'm going to move on to a section about answering questions and about participant management. That said, are there any questions on this segment before we move on to the next?
So there was just one comment, just that in the world of the government, they live in alphabet soup, that it's acronyms, acronyms, acronyms.
Mm.
And from a time-saving perspective, is it safe if they know that they're, the way they're describing it here, essentially if they're in a trusted or well-known group, can they skip defining every single acronym each time?
Yeah.
Just because they know.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. That's why they exist. But as soon as you start talking to an outsider, you want to be clear about, you know, what you're saying. I can't tell you how many times I've given talks with especially the military. Like, they love this, but the federal government as well, just more broadly, where somebody will introduce themselves and they'll say, you know, I'm Dave and I'm in TTP / you know, IPE, but sometimes I also am, you know, journeyman in, you know, QR1, and I have no idea what they're saying. And, you know, some of the people in the room do, but it turns out that some of the people in the room don't. So if you know that everybody understands it because that's your technical jargon with your group and everybody knows it, then by all means, just do it. Everybody will understand. It's clear. It's to the point. If you're not sure, it will help to either make a point of defining everything at first use or make a statement about it at the beginning. Say, if anybody doesn't know what I'm saying because I'm going to use a bunch of acronyms, please let me know and I will explain. And then from then on, explain if somebody raises their hand and says, I don't know what that means. But if you know that you're in an environment, if it's your colleagues and everybody uses the same jargon, then you're absolutely fine.
Okay, and
so
just the point of clarification, we did have one person ask, what does NARPM stand for, which is in the footer of your slides?
Do you want to field that one for me?
Yeah, I can. So NARPM stands for the National Association for Remedial Project Managers, which is a gathering of individuals that clean up hazardous waste sites. And actually, the reason why this training was put together was for individuals who would be participating in one of their training programs. So just wanted to bring
to
it on home.
With you because I was under the impression that everybody here is participating in NARPM, so that's why I'm like,
It's okay.
So for whoever asked that, I'm glad we're now all on the same page. All right, so I'm going to move on now to soliciting questions, to answering questions, and to managing participants, and then I'm going to wrap everything up with time to spare for all of you. So soliciting questions. First thing is, if you ask any questions, that has become a default, indirect way of ending a presentation, which is why I was so careful just a minute ago to make it clear that I was not actually done with the presentation, but I would be talking about questions and taking questions. In general, any questions has become a way of saying, and I'm done. So during a presentation, what you'll want to ask is, what questions do you have? And then even at the end of the presentation, you can say thank you as a wrap-up and what questions do you have. After you ask for questions, stop talking. This is actually really hard for people. So you want to wait several moments for them to think. This is a perfect time to have a drink of water, if you have water, because it gives you something to do, so you're not just there trying to continue and continue and continue. And about a month ago, I was co-facilitating with someone, and they would ask any questions. Are there any questions? Are you sure you don't have questions? I don't see any hands going up. Well, if there aren't any questions, I'm going to move on. All right, I'm moving on. They filled the space. They filled the time. So people didn't really feel like they had time to think of a question and then also didn't really have the opportunity to ask it even if they had it because it just there was no time. You filled it by talking. So it can be a little uncomfortable when you're standing in the front of the room and you have everybody's eyes on you and you're not talking. But there, like I mentioned before, there are points in the presentation where silence is your friend. And the first one is when asking, what questions do you have? The other is, if you do decide to use humor in any way, give people a second to actually make the connection and to laugh as well. I will say also that many cultures discourage students from asking teachers questions, so it implies that the teacher did a poor job of explaining the material. So you have to consistently encourage people to ask, and you have to be overt about it. So I did work last year in Japan. It was actually a mixed group of Japanese nationals and U.S. nationals working together. And the only way that I could get questions from the Japanese nationals, because of a cultural expectation around asking questions of a teacher being indicative that the teacher didn't do a good job, the only way that I could get them to ask questions was to explicitly state up front that I wanted questions, that the expectation that I had was that the participants should come up with questions, and that the questions are helpful to me and the participants are doing their job by asking questions. But otherwise, if I had just gone into that room and said, are there any questions, I would not have gotten any questions from half of the room, because there's a cultural expectation around what it means to ask a question. So you have to be clear about this and just say, you know, as I said up front, I welcome feedback, I welcome questions, I'm going to make time for it, and I look forward to helping clarify. But, you know, if you have to, you can even say your job is to ask questions if you have them. It's an extreme example, but it is something to be aware of, because we do live in a multicultural society, and you're giving talks to the general public, so you don't want to lose some portion of the room by just assuming that they'll ask you questions that they have when they won't. What you should do as well is rephrase the question and ask if that is accurate or correct before moving on. So this is a trademark of what's called active listening. And the idea is that you want to make sure that you're actually answering the right question to begin with. Also, depending on how much time you have to fill, it can be an effective technique. Say, you asked blah, 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 blah. I take that to mean blah, 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 blah. Is that correct? And they say yes, and then you answer the question. It can also help you frame how you want to answer the question. So you can decide whether or not to answer it as asked. But often, depending on the topic, people can have a hard time really phrasing the question in the best possible way. And so it helps, one, it helps the audience hear it, especially if an audience member asks, maybe not everybody can hear what the question was. So when you restate the question, people then all know what you're answering. Two, you know that you're answering the correct question. And three, it helps you frame it in the context of your talk. So definitely rephrase it and then ask if that's correct. And then I'll also say respond to everyone. So, you know, even though one person asks you one question, you start to lose a room when it looks like you're just having a conversation with one audience member. So you'll rephrase the question for everybody, and then you'll answer it for everyone. You're not just having a conversation with the questioner. You address your answer to the entire audience. And you should tie it back to your point. So you're going to think about what the elevator pitch of your presentation is, what the short version, what the tweet version of your presentation is. How do you summarize it? And keep that in mind when responding. Don't lose focus on your message. So people will sometimes ask really weird questions, and if it's not actually related to what you're trying to communicate, you don't actually have to answer that. You can say, you know, I'd like to discuss this with you offline after. You can say, I'd like to cycle back. Or you can then directly tie it to your presentation and say, well, as I said, blah, blah, blah. And therefore, the answer that I'll give to this question is blah, blah, blah. And it can be a partial answer if you want. So there's a lot here. But keep in mind, you are in charge. And it's really your day. It's your show. So I moved to the next slide here. I realized I hadn't pressed the button there. So like I said, you want to respond to everyone. You'll refer to the central theme of your speech. But you can feel free to postpone an answer or throw the question back to the group as well. It's another one that I left out earlier. Depending on what your audience is, sometimes it's easy to pass it to somebody else, which I actually just did with the NARPM thing. So I thought it was more effective to pass that question than to answer it myself. And the last thing I'll say is respect the questioner. Even if they're asking something a little challenging, you want to make a point of choosing to assume the best from that person. So if they ask a difficult question, if they ask a gotcha question, it's going to be much better for you as a presenter to assume, even if you know that it was asked in bad faith, assume that it was asked in good faith, rephrase it, tie it back to the theme of your speech. If they go on and say, well, no, I was really asking this, and say, well, I'd like to get to other questions, and I would love to discuss this more with you afterwards. So you have some options there. I'm going to move from answering questions to participant management, which we'll get into both regular, everyday participant management and then also managing tricky participants. And I'll talk about feedback and we'll wrap up. So effective speakers will use participants' names where possible. So if people have name tags or name cards or whatever, if they don't, then that's fine. But in general, I would say it helps to not point with a single index finger and say, you. if I'm going to point to somebody, usually I gesture with an open hand, with an open palm, and try and keep the palm, you know, up or at 45 degrees. It's, you know, if you forget this, it's fine, but in general, pointing is not always thought of as polite by people. And if you can use their names, that's easier. You should also reinforce desired and appropriate participant behaviors. Some cases that means stating exactly what you expect appropriate behavior to be. And then refer to previous contributions made by participants. So if somebody said something during your presentation, if you have questions and answers, then it's helpful to just refer back to the audience. Moving on to challenging behavior. What I will say is you want to respond appropriately to questions. Do not get hooked. Do not, you know, it's fine to have an emotional response, but that should not be your professional response. And you want to manage challenging participant behavior and make the experience enjoyable for everyone. So ways that you do that is, one, don't take it personally. It's their stuff. It's not yours. Two is you shouldn't argue and defend. If you do, your credibility immediately is diminished. So this is not a moment for you to just argue back with somebody else. You should avoid shutting them down as well, because when you shut somebody down, if you say, well, you know, that's a bad question or whatever, then it shuts down others in the room as well. So the key thing really is only react to the light side of the comment. Look for what they care about. Think about why they're asking the question and choose to take it in good faith. Again, you know, we often, well, not often, but sometimes have people who will say that the class is a waste of their time, or they'll put it in more colorful language than that. And, you know, all you can do in that case is what we do, which is thank the participant and promise that we'll do everything not to waste their time. And then, again, challenge them not to waste ours and to keep an open mind. I'll also say that you want to take care when answering what-if questions, because they devolve into a never-ending cycle and just waste everybody's time. And when you are asking questions, just to cycle back to that for a second, you want to make sure that you're asking open-ended questions to people if you're asking questions of the room. So, you know, closed questions start with do, have, will, can, are, is. They're basically yes-no questions where somebody can say yes or no. Now, be ready, even if you ask a yes or no question, you might get a long response from people if they're riled up about stuff, and you want to tie it directly back to your presentation. But if you want to solicit audience participation, you're going to ask what, where, when, how, who, like WH questions. And then as they ask questions, feel free, like I said, to tie it directly back to your talk, or tell people, you know, pass it off to other people, ask the room what they think about it, or say that I'd love to talk with you about this later offline, or in extreme cases, say that's not what we're here to discuss. Thank you for your comment, and you know, are there any other questions related to the actual content? If they're wrong, and this is on the slide that I just brought up, thank them for bringing up the topic and allowing you the chance to clarify. So I had a very contentious talk with some judges and court reporters based on research that I just did that's been picked up by the news, and had a participant who said, well, in your study, you did this and you did that and blah, 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 and it was all wrong. And the best thing you can do there is to say, thank you for bringing that up. This gives me an opportunity to clarify. That's actually not the study protocol, and I would love to take a moment to address what the study protocol was. But the trick is, don't get stuck repeating or clarifying. Once you've done it once, cut it and offer to discuss it offline later. Lastly, if the comment's not relevant, you just want to refocus and then keep it moving. We are almost at the end here. I promised that I would get you all out on time or early. But I want to take a moment to discuss the gift of feedback. So this is something that is very important at CulturePoint. We talk about this in almost every one of our talks, and I think it's hugely important, especially here. So the key, and it's right in the name here, is that feedback is a gift. Now, when I say feedback, I don't mean good job, way to go, attaboy. I mean actual constructive criticism of, you know, this needs work, or you can improve this, or, you know, something where you actually can learn from it and improve. And so that is, you know, effective feedback is specific rather than general. It should be focused, if you're making the feedback, it should be focused on behavior, not on the person. So, you know, saying you're a jerk is not useful at all. But saying, you know, you did this, this, and this, that is actionable, is good feedback. It's positive feedback that you can do something with. And it should be descriptive rather than evaluative. It should be concise. It should be well-timed. And by well-timed, I mean if you were giving feedback, you want to make sure that you have a appropriate context for it. If somebody can't handle the feedback at that moment, you want to cycle back to it later. And it should be checked. It should be something that you can verify. But if you receive feedback, there's two keys here. One, you should always welcome feedback. The two points, though, are if it doesn't follow these, it's not specific, it's evaluative instead of descriptive, it's not concise, try and read it in the best possible light and see what you can get from it that's useful. And if nothing's useful, then, you know, you tried. And if it is all of these things, then just take it for what it is, which is a gift. It's a way of improving your performance. It's a way of making sure that you actually can continue to develop in your presentations here, in your workplace, or whatever else. But if you get feedback on your presentation, you know, that's, even if it's negative feedback, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's just something that you can build on. With that said, I want to wrap up. I'm going to leave a little bit of time for Q&A and for the final wrap-up here. But the questions that I have for you are what have you learned about presentations? What have you learned about yourselves? And what will you do differently? You don't have to answer these for me right now, but these are takeaway questions for you to think about as you're developing your presentations for this, I guess it's the end of the summer. I was going to say this fall, but for this summer. So thank you all for your time. And like I said, I'm here for more questions, and I assume there will be plenty.
There are. So let's jump right in, reminding everyone that you can continue to send in questions or comments for Taylor using that Q&A window in the lower right corner. Our first question is asking, what's an appropriate amount of time to wait for people to ask questions?
I will usually wait up to about 30 seconds, which when you are presenting, I will say that 30 seconds feels like a very long time, but when you're on the other end of it, it's not terrible. Anywhere between 10 and 30 seconds, depending on the size of the room and whether you really expect people to have questions or you know, if you just knocked it out of the park and it was completely straightforward, then 10 seconds is more than enough. What I will say is you don't want to give, you know, like, 5 minutes. It's way too much.
Okay. And do you advise allowing for mid-presentation questions, or do you think it's better to wait and do Q&A at the end?
I personally prefer mid-presentation questions, but the vast majority of the presentations I give are 2 hours, 3 hours, 6 hours, so it really depends. If it's a 20-minute talk, if it's like a conference talk, then I will tell people, feel free to ask questions, but make sure that they're just clarifying questions, and I'm probably going to address it as I move through. And you can also say that when somebody asks a question, I will address that later, and just keep it moving. But for longer talks, I think it keeps people engaged to be able to ask questions and to ask them questions as well. So I recommend if you have really anything that's an hour or more, I would want to leave the option for people to ask questions as you're going through your presentation, with the expectation that some of them are things that you'll just say, I'll address that later, thank you for asking, and tell me if I didn't at the end, and I'll address it then.
Okay. I think you hit on this a little bit earlier, but just to remind everyone, why do a lot of speakers respond by saying, quote, that's a good question. Should I do that? Is there something that I'm missing by not saying that?
So you don't have to say it in exactly that way, but in general, I think thanking the person for their question is just a good audience management skill. Sometimes people don't. They just answer the question. But it can start to feel a little contentious sometimes. So I think the real reason for that is it is a politeness formulation that helps keep people sort of friendly in the room. It doesn't have to be that's a good question. If you don't think it was a good question, then you don't have to say that's a good question. But usually I'll always say thank you for your question, blah, 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 blah. You'll notice for some of these questions, especially because I don't see anybody, I don't see who's asking the question, I'll just answer the question because you're asking me directly. But for a room where you're in person, it always helps to just say thank you for that. To answer your question, well, thank you for that, and if I understand correctly, you're asking X. For those of you who didn't hear the question was X, to answer that, blah, 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 blah.
Okay, so it's not, as someone is chiming in now, a stalling tactic, because some people interpret the statement like that as a stalling technique to give the speaker more time to think of the answer.
I hope not, although if that works for you, then feel free. I don't know. I mean, I think in answering questions like that, there's no real issue. If you are using it as a stalling tactic, there's no real issue with just saying, give me a second, and then pausing for a second, or even just pausing for a second and then answering the question. I think people expect you to think about your responses. It can feel uncomfortable, again, to be silent in front of an audience. But if you need to think about how to organize your thoughts, you can even just say, that's interesting. Let me think about how to answer that. Well, we can start with blah, 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 blah.
Okay.
If you're really stalling, then it shows and it's a problem.
Right. Okay. So we've actually had a few people chime in on this one type of question. So essentially, they're asking, how do you address a singular participant who seems to be monopolizing the Q&A period? So either they keep repeatedly raising their hands and asking questions, not giving someone else a chance to do it, or perhaps they just keep going on in their question, providing tons of background. Is there a way to interrupt them and kind of move on, or a technique that they should use?
As far as techniques, I don't necessarily have anything specific. What I will say is, again, if you are the presenter, you're standing at the front of the room, you have the microphone, you are in charge, and so you can absolutely just cut them off. Now, you want to do that as politely as possible, so you can say, thank you, I believe your question is this. If they go, no, I was asking this, you can say, all right, well, let's clarify after the discussion. I'd like to allow other people to ask questions. It can feel a little uncomfortable sometimes, but again, I think the thing to keep in mind is that this is a professional performance where you are in charge of the room and it is your job. And so it's a little bit different than just having a conversation with a bunch of people. And part of that means that, you know, you have a little bit more leeway because you are in charge, and people will respect that you are in charge for this moment.
Okay, moving on to a classic question about the use of ums and ahs as space fillers. Mm. How do you feel about
yeah.
that? It seems like for some speakers it's great, and then for others it can be really detrimental.
I'm very conflicted about that, and what I will say is the reason that I'm very conflicted about that is that I am a sociolinguist, and so people study this, and in general we look at language descriptively rather than prescriptively. We don't say this is what you should do, we say this is what people do. Now, I recognize that people are socially evaluated based on how they speak. And people are evaluated when they give presentations, and so you want to be aware of that. So we're in sort of there's a tension here between my professional opinion that you should not be judged for how you speak, and if you say amen, that's no problem. And I can point to a variety of papers in linguistics that explore how people say amen, and when and how they use it, and the fact that it has a social function. But you will be evaluated for it. The general public does not necessarily have the same mindset as trained linguists. And I think the reason that people make those evaluations is in part that using and using are strategies for effectively for keeping your turn in conversation. And when you're giving a presentation, you're not really in conversation with people. You are expected to have a monopoly on that. You're expected to have a monologue, effectively. So if you were concerned that you will be judged for saying amen because you say it a lot naturally, or maybe you've been criticized for it, what I will say is that it takes a little bit of practice, but what you can do is literally just pause there. You don't have to say anything, and you'll be fine. So a lot of the places where I pause, I would normally say or in casual speech, and I've trained myself when talking to anything more than five people to just pause there instead. That takes a little bit of practice. And what I will say more broadly is that people are negatively evaluated based on how they speak or positively evaluated based on how they speak, and those things are social rather than inherent to the language. But as presenters, they are things that you should be aware of. It's not fair. It's not right. But for the moment, it's something that you have to deal with. And so ums and uhs, I'm sure I said a few. I try and keep it to a minimum when presenting. But as far as eliminating it from your day-to-day speech, that's really should not be an issue. I'm saying right now because I'm primed. But to summarize all of that, you will be evaluated a little bit for it. I think women may be more likely to be negatively evaluated for ums and uhs and for high-rising terminal in sentences that's list intonation and for allowing their voices to dip below 70 hertz where you can actually hear the individual glottal pulses, which is usually referred to as creaky voice. It's something that men do all the time, but which women are negatively evaluated for and men are not evaluated for at all. So there are all these ways that people are evaluated, and that includes saying things like ax instead of ask, and saying an om and and asking tag questions like right, that you should be aware of. But again, I think it's much easier to think about it as part of your 20-minute presentation, and this is my job for this 20 minutes, and something you practice for that, and not as a character flaw or an individual problem that you have to address in all aspects of your life.
Okay, so the next question gets into how to project confidence on a topic that you're not actually confident about. And they were very good. They gave me some background here, essentially saying that because of a high turnover rate in staff, they are being asked internally to train new hires on things that they themselves may not have had experience with. And so should they just be honest that they don't really know anything about this topic, or should they be doing something else to project the sense of confidence when they're talking about something that is not their forte?
I think there's a combination of things here. So I will not recommend being dishonest or disingenuous or duplicitous or any other D word. What I will say is that there's a balance to strike, but you want to train people up as best as you can, and then, be honest with them about the fact that it is outside of your wheelhouse. That said, you can frame it in a positive way where you don't deauthorize yourself. And I think that's the crucial point here. So if I'm giving a talk, for instance, one of my co-authors gave a talk at a sociology conference on a paper that we co-wrote. It's a sociology and sociolinguistics paper. I was supposed to be there, but I had to give a different talk. So she gave a talk. She's the sociologist. She knows everything inside and out about the sociological aspects of the paper, but was asked questions about the linguistics part. When she was confident in it, she would say, well, I think, Taylor's not here, and he's probably the best person to answer that question, but I believe that he would say X, Y, and Z. When she was not confident in it, she would say, this is something that I understand that it is X, Y, and Z, but you know the linguist on the paper may have further clarification for you, and I would direct you to them. If you can direct people to somebody who will know, that's ideal. If you can't and you're just in this bind where you got to train people up on something that's outside of your wheelhouse, you want to be honest with them about your limitations, but also recognize that you know you've been with the organization for longer, you're training people into something new, and that you have a responsibility to them, but you also know more than they do about the organization and about part of the material. The rest of it, you know, you may want to point them to where they can hopefully find help. But don't sell yourself short. That's the last piece.
Okay, I think we'll take one more question in the time that we have. And several people have asked questions about particular groups. So, for instance, one participant wanted to know how military briefings might be handled differently than other presentations. And someone else was asking about the difference between talking to the public versus senior management versus an academic environment. So I think maybe a broad just reflection on working with different types of audiences when giving that presentation. Any thoughts you want to close out with?
Yeah, so I think that's a fantastic question, and I'm not stalling by saying that. I cracked myself up. I've had a lot of experience talking to very different audiences, and what I will say is that there's certain audiences where I know exactly what to expect, and there's others where you kind of play it by ear. So military audiences, there's an organizational culture, and this is something we could talk for hours and hours about. But with the military, I know that they expect direct communication. I know that they expect bottom line up front, and then we'll backfill if I skip some points that they need for clarification. And I know exactly, you know, how they expect to be spoken to. Civilian audiences are all over the map, which, you know, it's because we don't have indoctrination into a particular organizational culture with expectations around how presentations go. Academics tend to easily get into the weeds with very specific, detailed, nuanced questions. If you're familiar with the comic XKCD, there's a particular comment about nerd sniping, which is, you know, saying that you can just trap people with too detailed questions and they spin out. But it really depends on the audience. I'll say don't fall back on stereotypes if you can. But if you know generalizations that are accurate about a group, then you can play to those strengths. So if you know that you're talking to a room full of scientists and that they may be easily, you know, nerd sniped, then you can tailor your presentation to it and explicitly state, like, I don't want to go down any of these rabbit holes. I'm making this point. We could talk about it after the session, but I'm making this point to say this, this, and this. That comes with practice and that comes with experience, and I think the fact that you're even asking that question indicates a level of awareness that will serve you well.
All right. I think we'll go ahead and close out this Q&A period with about 2 minutes to spare, and I'll walk through final reminders for everyone. But before I do that, I want to, Taylor, extend my thanks again for joining us for this encore presentation. I also want to thank the over 250 people who joined us from across the U.S. for today's live delivery. Remember, if you're interested in free online training like this, although we tend to focus on technical presentations for hazardous waste site cleanup, we do offer other topics. You'll find them on the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org. You're also welcome to sign up for our free monthly newsletter that goes out on the first of each month called Tech Direct. I will remind everybody that copies of the presentation material can be accessed from the seminar resources page. You'll find that under the middle right of your screen under related URLs. If you're looking for contact information for our organizers and speakers, we also have that posted, but you're certainly welcome to reach out to me at ballant.jean@epa.gov. And I will ask each of you to take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form. One of the most common questions I get is if we offer CEUs or PDHs for our sessions. While we do not issue those types of credit hours, we can provide you with a participation certificate after you complete our online feedback form. So simply follow the link to the seminar feedback form, fill that thing out completely. I do read each and every one of them, so please know that your feedback is addressed. And make sure that you check the box at the bottom to certify you were here for the whole session. Once you send that feedback form in, you'll then have immediate access to download or print out a certificate. If you happen to participate in a group, each person can fill out their own feedback form. So you don't have to be the registrant. Each one of you can fill it out. Just simply get the feedback form link from the registrant, and you can fill it out on your own time to get your own certificate. And then lastly, today's session was recorded, and you will automatically get an email once we have that archive available. So with that, again, I'm echoing my thanks to our presenters and organizers who joined us today, as well as all of you out there who participated in today's session, shared your questions and your comments, and I think made this a great seminar. We'll go ahead and